This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Islamist terrorist attacks in Belgium on Tuesday killed dozens of people right at the headquarters city of the European Union. We're going to talk about the response among Europeans, how this raises additional alarm about the immigrants flooding into the continent from the Middle East, and how it heightens tensions with Muslims. President Barack Obama visited Cuba this week, the first sitting U.S. president to do so since 1928. This was a big step in the president's efforts to normalize relations with this longtime enemy. But why were these two nations enemies in the first place? We're going to talk about what is going on in Cuba and about the history of this situation, some of it quite recent, that is being overlooked in the pursuit of this relationship. A growing health concern today is brain diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's disease. These are affecting more and more people. A new study shows that you can actually improve your brain volume and significantly reduce your susceptibility to these diseases through exercise. We're going to talk with certified personal trainer Jorg Mardian about how physical activity can improve your brain health. And we'll conclude today's show with a bit of sound, simple, rock-solid advice on what to put in your mouth. All this on today's Trumpet Hour. Yesterday morning, terrorist attacks rocked Belgium, the European nation sandwiched right between France and Germany. A series of attacks killed 34 people across the city. Two explosions struck the Brussels airport. Another blast killed 20 right near the European Union headquarters in central Brussels. This comes just after the arrest of one of the suspects in the Paris attack from last November. One Belgian minister warned just this week of revenge strikes, and here we are. And to talk about these latest attacks and the ramifications, I have with me here in the studio trumpet writer Robert Morley, and via Skype from our office in Britain, Richard Palmer. Hello, gentlemen.
Hello.
Good afternoon.
First of all, there is quite a bit of evidence that this was an Islamic attack, and there was reports that one of them, at least, was a suicide bomber. What's some of the evidence pointing to the Islamic State and some Islamic source for this these events?
Well, I think it's important to realize that in the lead up to this event, and just the days prior to this event, intelligence agencies had been warning that a terrorist attack, the threat of attack had gone up, and a threat of an attack was even perhaps imminent. Just 3 or 4 days prior to this, I think they had just arrested the main perpetrator of the Paris attacks, and now France was trying to extradite him. And I think intelligence agencies were picking up chatter at that time that something might be imminent. Then, of course, when the bombs went off, the two bombs that went off at the airport, prior to that, there was a lot of gunfire that took place. So these terrorists had made it into the airport with weapons. And as they were shooting, there was a lot of shouting in Arabic that news agencies are reporting. Also, they are collecting evidence at the scene. There was unexploded ordnance that were left behind, bomb belts filled with shrapnel and rusty nails and things like that that actually didn't go off. So it could have been even worse than what actually took place there. So I think that that, just along with a lot of the threats, Islamic State had been threatening to, I think you mentioned earlier, somebody mentioned earlier, to turn Brussels basically into a war zone. So I think it's those things together coming at this time that have really so far been the primary indicators of this being an Islamic terrorist attack.
Just within the past, as we're recording this, just within the past couple of minutes, they've just released, Islamic State has just released a statement via its official news agency claiming responsibility. So,
well, there you go.
So they came out just now and said it was them.
It is interesting. Let's talk about the response within within Europe, within Belgium, within the people. It seems like we've been tracking this for quite a while. We've had a number of events that have happened, and last November when the Paris attacks hit, there's definitely a much quicker response turning against the Islamic presence within Europe, a much quicker reaction and less of the politically correct, well, let's not overreact and let's not blame Islam. What has been the response in this case?
Well, I think you're right about that. Although in this case, I think beyond just the shock that this is happening once again to people, I think there is still a sense of disbelief that Europe has changed as much as it has. I think there is a lot of people within Europe that don't want to believe that Europe is fundamentally different today from what it was even 10 years ago or 15 years ago. Brussels used to be one of the safest, biggest big cities in the world. I mean, crime there was virtually zero, as some politicians have pointed out. And now we have bombs going off in the city, killing dozens of people. The hashtag Pray for Belgium was trending. And politically, we saw a lot of statements from various presidents and prime ministers expressing condolences and solidarity with the Belgians. I think the phrase, we are all Belgians, within Europe has kind of gained traction. So there is that. But there's also, even as you mentioned, there is a growing sense that there's this problem in Europe. There was still, you could just see it. Politicians went out of their way to make sure that they talked about this in terms of this was an evil thing that happened. There was a lot of hatred involved here. A lot of people labeled it as terrorism, as it clearly was terrorism. But there was, within a lot of places, even Donald Tusk, I think, there was a lack of identifying where the terrorism is coming from. There wasn't this overt, there was, these are Muslim terrorists and we have a problem with Islam in Europe. Now, I think that is changing because there were some strong statements that have come out. So, for example, France, the French prime minister, he came out and said specifically, we are at war. We have been subject to war for the last few months and to acts of war. The Polish prime minister, he came out and said, the fight against terrorism is the duty of every one of us. France's chief of defense came out and talked about how terrorism is gaining in Europe because of the Islamic State. There is this nation that now exists, he said, that's providing funding to terrorists. And he came out and actually said that the only way to stop this is to deny these radical Islamic terrorists the finances and their safe havens, basically, over in the Middle East. So there is this growing sense within at least some in Europe that to stop the threat, it needs to be confronted head on, and that even to stop it, it needs to be confronted in foreign nations. So we're starting to see the focus of Europe to wake up to this reality that they really are in a different world than they were a decade ago.
Right. It seems like when you have an attack like this, these types of attacks, it really blows holes in the illusion that they can continue to kick this can down the road, that they can ignore these things. It forces people to confront the reality that there really is a clash of civilizations here. So we were talking last week, Richard, about just what happened politically within Germany, right next door to Belgium last week, and just how much you've seen this hardening of German public opinion against the Merkel administration, more support for anti-immigration parties. This is a trend that we're seeing hitting nations all over the European Union. This type of attack plays into that trend perfectly.
It does, and this is where I want to kind of add a bit to what Rob just said, because it absolutely is important to recognize that there is a change in rhetoric and a change in tone from European leaders. But at the same time, a lot of mainstream leaders are still living in this left-wing kind of fantasy world. They've not left that yet. So there are those strong statements, and that is big news that they're making those statements. That's quite the contrast to how it was last year. But at the same time, a lot of leaders are saying things like, this doesn't change anything regarding immigration. This isn't anything to do with Islam. Those kind of statements that we always used to from European leaders every time a terrorist attack is made, they're still saying that kind of thing. Now, one of the big things that has changed this time around is now you have a lot of prominent fringe politicians that are willing to say the things that these mainstream leaders won't say. And so, for example, the top leader of AFD, she posted a Facebook page earlier today already talking about the attack, but this has nothing at all to do with anything, is what she wrote. And that's gaining a lot of attention in Germany. In Britain, you've got UKIP immediately drawing the connections now between the EU and the open border zone there within the EU and the fact that these Muslims can move unhindered. So the fact that you've had these right-wing groups rise now mean that you have prominent politicians who are saying things that just about no prominent politicians were saying before, and that are taking this much more common sense response to what's happening in Europe. And then what you're going to see from that is them get more popularity, and then it's going to force some of these mainstream leaders who are already becoming firmer, it's going to force them to be even firmer still. Otherwise, they'll just risk seeing their support completely eaten up by these new right-wing leaders.
Well, it's not difficult at all to see how some of the harder rhetoric that you would hear from more of the right-wing politicians would expose just how hollow some of that rhetoric is from those more mainstream politicians, that people could hear that and basically say, well, that's exactly the kind of illusion-based thinking that got us into the mess in the first place, and be that much more reactionary against those politicians.
Right, and here's some analysis from IHS that, you know, that makes very similar points. They write the explosions carry a number of implications for Europe. First, there is a growing perception among European public opinion that EU leaders are not in control of the continent's terrorist threat. So if people are afraid that their leaders aren't keeping them safe, which is the most fundamental job of a leader, you know, you look pretty hard for new leaders. So that's going to have a big impact on these right-wing groups that are promising to be a lot tougher on terror. Then they write, combined, these attacks will increase xenophobic and anti-immigrant sentiment across the EU, which has already been rising in the light of the EU's ongoing refugee crisis. Next, it is likely this sentiment will be captured by extremist right-wing parties in the core of Europe and Central Eastern Europe too. These parties have and will to continue to conflate refugees with terrorism. And then it talks about how it's going to start putting real strain on the European Union and on the Schengen open border zone that is already almost fallen apart.
It is remarkable that this happened right in the wake of the stricter security that was put in place after the Paris attacks. And it was right after the arrest of this mastermind behind that, or one of the main perpetrators of the terrorist attacks in Paris. It does expose that they haven't gone far enough. How does the average citizen in Europe not conclude that we need to take even firmer measures?
I think that's a great question. And I think there's some big implications in Europe from that. I think that this immigration crisis that you were just talking about, Richard, you know, the right-wing parties, you're saying conflating terrorists with refugees. Well, I think it is a legitimate question. I mean, how are these terrorists getting into Europe? They're not just homegrown. There is a homegrown, but there are terrorists. All the intelligence agencies are very firm about this, coming in with those migrants. So this is a question. And I think in terms of Europe, we see Angela Merkel still in a driver's seat about European immigration policy. Now, what happens now? What happens now that 31 people were blown up inside an airport and in front of the parliament buildings of the European Union? And I think that's an interesting question.
And just to build off that, there's more and more reports showing that there are multiple Islamic State terror cells within Europe actively planning attacks in other countries. So exactly as Rob said, there are more coming. There was a report from Germany just this morning that the guy that was arrested last week as part of an ISIL network set up to explicitly carry out attacks in other countries, including Germany. And that was published in Tagspieler. And they said that there were around 30 members divided into separate cells, and that they're planning strikes in Germany. The Telegraph interviewed a terror network saying that a terrorist expert saying that the coordinated attacks on the Brussels airport and metro system show Islamic State-inspired terrorist networks have become embedded in Europe with the capacity to become operational within days. So we're just, you know, these attacks show that there is a great underground capability here, and it's only a matter of time before you get an attack on something like the European Parliament or within other countries.
You mentioned some of these politicians who are still clinging to the idea that this has nothing to do with Islam and let's not overreact. But when you look at what's coming from the Islamic State, both in rhetoric and in action, they're being very upfront about their desire to actually provoke a war with Europe. And they're trying to be as upfront and explicit about it as they can be.
I think you're right. And I think the politicians have done Europeans great disservice. All these ones who refuse to acknowledge reality. Now we're having revelations that this terrorist that was arrested just 4 days ago, it is far beyond just a lone wolf type situation. Now, this is kind of what a lot of politicians would like in Europe would like people to believe, it seems, from their rhetoric, that he acted alone or he's just a small group, maybe just his family members supporting him. But now the intelligence agencies are saying that this is a much bigger network. It goes far beyond his family. It's fully embedded within members within the Muslim community within Europe. And now they're even saying it may have extended even to organized crime within Europe. So this is getting to be a huge, huge problem.
And it gets back to that point that we made last year after the Charlie Hebdo attacks, where George Friedman wrote that excellent article on Stratfor, where he talked about you have some Muslims will commit these crimes. There's no test that the police force can do to tell who is a Muslim that's going to blow themselves up and who isn't. There's no way that it is possible to protect every single soft target in Europe. You can't even protect every single railway station in Europe. And so ultimately you'll get down to the choice between either tolerating a certain level of attacks or stigmatizing and cracking down on all Muslims. And it's getting closer to the time where Europe is going to face that choice. And as he pointed in that article, history and human nature tell us Europe is going to ultimately end up cracking down on all Muslims.
And it's really the conversation that we're having. This is one of the biggest, if not the biggest trend that we follow on thetrumpet.com and in the Trumpet magazine, because of the biblical prophecy of a confrontation between a European empire and a radical Islamic force that originates in the Middle East, provoking World War III. And that clash, it really is right on the doorstep. You can see the actions of these radicals. You can see the response within Europe building toward an epic confrontation. We've been talking with Trumpet writers Robert Morley and Richard Palmer about these terrorist attacks in Belgium that happened on Tuesday morning. You can read more about this on thetrumpet.com. This is part of ongoing reporting on the rising tension between radical Islam and Europe. Thanks for your time, gentlemen.
Thank you for having me.
Great to be here.
This is the voice of the Trumpet News Magazine. You're listening to Trumpet Hour.
President Barack Obama traveled to Cuba this week. He and the Cuban leader, Raul Castro, met at the Revolutionary Palace on Monday. They held a press conference at which President Obama declared a new day of openness between the two nations. It was the first time a sitting U.S. president has visited Cuba since 1928. To talk about this historic visit and what happened there and what it means for these two nations, I have Trumpet writer Andrew Miller here with me. Hello, Andrew.
Hello. Good to be here.
So yes. Let's go back and remind listeners of some of the background. How did this visit come about?
Yeah, well, this has been a couple years unfolding. We actually had covered this at the Trumpet at the time when the Cubans had fairly good relations with Pope Francis and had reached out to him as a liaison to try to get the embargo the United States had against them lifted. And so he's actually the one who set up this deal where U.S. officials were able to meet with Cuban officials in Canada and start this process of restoring full diplomatic sanctions between the Castro administration and the Obama administration.
And what is the Obama administration hoping to accomplish with this?
It's actually a pretty good question because they they're still in negotiations to get these embargo lifted. But they, the Castro administration's really given nothing in return. They've done no human rights reforms. They've done really anything. It's pretty much just all the Obama administration's talking about lifting sanctions, no strings attached.
Okay, well, let's go ahead and take this further back in history. The U.S. has had this embargo in place against Cuba since 1960. What were the problems within Cuba that brought this about? What was the U.S. trying to accomplish with the embargo?
Right. Well, if you go back all the way to the 1940s, Cuba was ruled by a man, like a strong man, who was regarded as a dictator, not a really nice guy, but a pro-American dictator in like the same strain as like Gaddafi or some of these other Middle Eastern leaders that have been toppled recently in the Arab Spring. In World War II, the Nazis had tried to use U-boats to take over the Panama Canal in an attempt to cripple the U.S. economy. And this Cuban strongman had helped us with him with repelling that invasion. So we'd had fairly good relations with the Cuban regime at the time. But because it was authoritarian, Castro had led this this socialist uprising, which morphed into a civil war against that rule. And it was based on a lot of lies. I mean, Castro, he said, I'm a democratic socialist, I'm for free elections, I'm for free press, I'm not going to nationalize anything. I think I'd even had one quote here where as late as 1959, he says, we are not communists, neither myself nor the movement is communist. And yet within 2 years after he came to power, he claimed, actually this is another quote, he said, I'm a Marxist-Leninist and I will remain so for the rest of my life. So when the United States had realized that we now have a Marxist-Leninist organization allied with the Soviet Union 80 miles or 90 miles off our border, we put the embargo in place as a protective measure to keep espionage or weapons or political warfare coming from Cuba, originating as it's like a Soviet base.
Right. This is much more than just an ideological kinship between the Castro regime and communist ideals. This is basically a gateway for the Soviet Union to attack the United States.
Right. Well, especially during the Cold War when the Soviet Union was still in place. I mean, it's actually kind of amazing is that it's not even the same ideological system in place in Cuba. It's actually the same two guys who've been running it for since the 60s or late 50s. And a lot of older Americans remember the Cuban Missile Crisis, where the Soviet Union almost did use Cuba as a base to launch nuclear missiles into the United States with full cooperation from the Castro regime. So we put that embargo in place to prevent things like that from happening.
So President Obama is basically saying the time has come for us to bury the nuclear hatchet, if you will.
Right. I had another quote from him. He says, I'm not interested in having battles that started before I was born. So apparently he doesn't care that the president of Cuba actually was born then and was cooperating with the Soviet Union. He said it's happened half a century ago. We'll let bygones be bygones and try to open a new chapter in U.S.-Cuban relations. Which that's kind of an amazing stance in itself, considering it literally is the same two guys in charge now as it was then. But if he wants to take that stance of just considering more recent activities, this had 2011, Cuban officials negotiated with the Iranian-backed terrorist group Hezbollah to set up an operational base in Cuba. That's 5 years ago. 2013, that's 3 years ago, the Cubans sought to mislead the world by hiding nuclear weapons and sacks of sugar in a North Korean ship sailing from Cuba to North Korea. So they've been very cuddly with the Kim Jong-un administration in North Korea. 2014, that's only 2 years ago, they had an unarmed U.S. Hellfire missile that was somehow mistakenly shipped from Cuba to Europe. To Cuba from Europe. And so they'd gotten, there's maybe a little bit more vague as to how that happened. This European missile just ended up in Cuba someplace, but there's definitely people in the U.S. Security agencies who are thinking that the Cuban espionage agencies may have been pulling some strings to get that ship to just reroute. It's a fuzzy area.
So a whole lot to suggest that just Cuba is very strategically important to enemies of the United States, 90 miles off the U.S. coast. It's basically like a permanent aircraft carrier that's sitting right there, or a military launch point. into U.S. soil. But even with the Castro regime, there is also a lot of talk about human rights violations and jailing of dissidents and the way that they treat political opposition. Maybe you could just fill us in on some of those concerns as well.
Right. That's another big shocker, is that originally President Obama said he would not meet with the Castros until there was some evidence of human rights reform in Cuba. And says, in fact, President Obama is in Cuba today, and there's been no evidence of human rights reform. In fact, from the time President Obama made this deal with Cuba in 2015 till the end of that very same year, there were 8,000 arrests of political dissidents in Cuba. Just hours before President Obama's plane landed in Cuba for the meeting he's having now, they made 50 more arrests of political dissidents. So you can see that he's made this claim that he's not going to meet with them unless there's political reform. And while his plane's in the air coming from Washington, D.C., they make 50 more arrests of people who are opposed to the communist regime.
This is something that Raul Castro really bristled against. When this was brought up at the press conference that they had together on Monday, there was a reporter that was asking him about this, and he said, well, you know, just show me the list. You give me the names, we'll let them go. There are no political prisoners here. But the reality is quite the opposite. He's playing as if he has no idea what they're talking about. But there are a lot of people in Cuba who are really up in arms against what the regime has done there.
Right. Yeah, I'm sure he's playing semantics in some way there, where what we'd consider a political dissidence against a communist regime, he probably considers a common criminal. So he's saying, well, I haven't arrested anybody for political reasons. Mm-hmm. I've only arrested people for criminal reasons.
Right. And there are a lot of organizations that can show him the list and have shown him the list. And the U.S. administration actually says, well, we've given you a lot of names of these people. This was really a point of contention between President Obama and Castro, and yet he still had sunshine and smiles.
Right, and that's I don't believe President Obama's wanted to bring this up, but I know the U.S. FBI and the New Jersey State Police Department are quite upset about a Black Panther activist from the 70s named Asada Shakur, who she was charged with killing a New Jersey State Police officer. She was put in prison. A group of Black nationalists helped her break out and smuggled her into Cuba, where Castro, Fidel Castro, granted her asylum. Still alive and living there till this day, even though she's on the FBI's most wanted list. And I think there's like a $2 million reward out for her arrest. And so a lot of the New Jersey State Police Department's really come out strong. They said, no, this Black Panther activist killed one of our state troopers. She's on the FBI's most wanted list. We can't restore diplomatic relations with Cuba until she's extradited. The Cuba regime has been very firm that no way we're ever giving this person back. She's here for life. They've been trying to pressuring Mr. Obama to bring that up, although he hasn't for right now. I know he has good relations with the Black Lives Matter movement, and you'll see a lot of Black Lives Matter protests. Asada Shakur is her name's on the placard, so she's kind of like a hero to that activist movement. So I doubt he'd hurt relations with the Black Lives Matter movement by bringing that up with the Castros. But that is another one of the very not even high profile Cuban dissidents, someone who'd be regarded as a high profile American dissident, currently having asylum status in Cuba.
Just to underline his contempt for the United States, even while they were having that press conference on Monday, as President Obama was indelicately bringing up some of these human rights violations, Raul Castro started to criticize the United States for its human rights violations. Well, you don't provide universal health care and education and equal pay. You're not in any position to lecture Cuba about these things. You still have this base in Guantanamo Bay. You need to close that down. He's lecturing the United States on how we need to run our business. I mean, if there's any evidence that this normalization of relations hasn't worked for the United States' favor, that's pretty good evidence.
Right, and I think some of those issues that Castro brought up really strike at the heart of why the Obama administration wants to normalize relations with Cuba in the first place. This is a quote from Mr. Obama regarding that criticism. He says, President Castro, I think, has pointed out that in his view, making sure that everybody is getting decent education or health care or basic security in old age, that those things are human rights as well. And I know for those who've kept up with some of the political debates, there was a little bit of a brouhaha over a video that surfaced of Bernie Sanders in 1985 just praising the Castro regime for how they'd brought free health care to everybody and how they'd brought free education to everybody. Mm-hmm. And they played this at one of the Democratic debates and said, well, what's your stance on this? And he's like, well, no. He said, I definitely stand by that the Castro regime's done amazing things for free health care and free education and all these socialist programs that I'd really like to implement here in America. He said, my only beef with the Castros is they've done that in an authoritarian way instead of a democratic socialist way. And President Obama, being a democratic socialist in his college years, he hasn't at least overtly said so more recently, I think would agree with a lot of that line of reasoning, that they do like a lot of the socialist reforms on healthcare and education that Cuba's implemented, while still criticizing his dictatorial means of doing so. It's a little naive in that I think Ronald Reagan phrased it best when he said a government strong enough to give you everything you want is also strong enough to take away everything you have. Remember when Castro was coming to power in the 50s, he was all free elections, democratic socialism, free rights of press. But when the Cuban people turned over enough power to him to be able to do all these free health care and manage the entire economy from a central planning use, I mean, his high-sounding ideals of democratic socialism lasted about 2 years before he declared himself an outright Marxist, Leninist leader in alliance with the Soviet Union. So that is a risk you always take when you give the government that level of power over your life.
Well, it is very interesting to watch this, the president down in Cuba talking with Mr. Castro and trying to tippy-toe around some of the pricklier issues between the two nations and act like everything is all sunshine in the future. We'd like to remind listeners of the article that the Trumpet publisher, Gerald Flurry, editor-in-chief Gerald Flurry, wrote last year about the deadly, dangerous U.S.-Cuba deal. That article can be found on thetrumpet.com, and it details why Cuba is so strategically important, why it's something that we really need to keep our eyes on and watch to see the way that America's enemies use against the United States. We've been talking with Trumpet writer Andrew Miller here. He's written an article about this visit. You can watch for that online at thetrumpet.com. Thank you, Andrew, for your time.
All right. Good to be here.
This is Trumpet Hour with Joel Hilliker.
How healthy is your brain? Diseases like dementia and Alzheimer's disease affect more and more people. The Alzheimer's Association says that the latter disease affects 5.1 million Americans today, and it's projected to grow dramatically in the coming years. A new study shows, though, that you can actually improve your brain volume and significantly reduce your susceptibility to these diseases through exercise. To talk about how physical activity can improve your brain health, I have certified personal trainer Jorg Mardian speaking to us via Skype from his training facility in British Columbia. Hello, Jorg.
Hello there. How are you?
I'm doing great. So the effects of inactivity, they're pretty well known when it comes to physical health problems like obesity, loss of mobility, heart health, that type of thing. But this study gives us some insight into the effects of inactivity on brain health. Can you tell us some of the findings here? Just tell us about the study and about the consequences of inactivity on the brain.
Well, sure. We know that exercise itself is good for the body and for the heart. And we've known that for a long time. This study is actually a reconfirmation of what we knew, that actually exercise is great for the mind as well. And we're just adding on to the knowledge of what we know now. And fitness is actually a critical component for the brain. And they're finding that the brain can actually grow. We can actually have increased neuron activity with a certain type of exercise with this study. So this study really focused on aerobic activity specifically. And it doesn't have to be a big amount either. However, what's exciting is that if we do this activity, our brain stays sharp into old age. And that is really exciting that we can actually add on, even in old age, to how our mind thinks and how our mind stays active. It's been proven that new brain cells can actually be generated and through what's called neurogenesis. And it's just like the muscles or the heart, it helps to bulk up the brain. Now, the problem with this is the message getting out to the public. Right. And the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that adults get about 2 to 2.5 hours of cardio and 2 days of muscle strengthening every week at a minimum. But yet only 20% of adults meet this guideline. So is the message getting out? It doesn't really look like it. So what are the consequences of that? You already mentioned that Alzheimer's is probably the most well-known form of cognitive disease, and it affects over 5 million people now. 5 million. And that number is projected to rise to over 13 million by the year 2050. And annually, about 23,000 people die from the disease. So it's not a small consequence. Now, globally, it gets even worse. There's a new case of dementia found every 4 seconds globally. So researchers say, again, by 2015, about 115 million people will have dementia worldwide. So it's a big problem.
So this study that you're talking about, first of all, who conducted the study and what was the scope of the study?
There's numerous studies. We have studies at the University of British Columbia. There's numerous studies that have been done on this in various ways with various types of exercises.
And they're basically finding the common thread in the findings is this correlation between exercise, some kind of exercise, and the brain's ability to stave off some of those effects of old age that tend to be there.
Well, exactly. It's not only that, but I think scientists are getting really excited about this because they're calling it a cognitive superstar. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is no small matter because they're saying it boosts the part of the brain responsible for memory and learning. So, and this happens in simple terms because there's a molecule called FNDC5. And there's a byproduct of that called irisin. And they become elevated in the brain when we do exercise. So very scientific. But what it does is it crosses the blood-brain barrier. And then this BDNF actually activates genes that cause us to become smarter and to learn faster. The network of cells that we have, we can actually add on to them through exercising. So rather than degenerating with inactivity, we can actually add on to that and just keep that brain very active and smart and sharp, even as we age.
So how close is the correlation that they discovered in these studies from the standpoint of, is the rise in sedentary activity, the loss of the less that people are exercising or the people are getting movement in their lives, is that actually contributing to the rise in Alzheimer's, dementia, and some of these other brain conditions?
Well, yes. We know there's a study from UCLA Medical Center and the University of Pittsburgh that shows that virtually any type of physical activity can improve that brain structure. But here's the important part. If we exercise, then Alzheimer's can be reduced as a prevention by 50 to 60%. I mean, that's an astounding number. We know as a prevention we can reduce it. So conversely, the opposite can happen. If we don't do it and dementia is rising, then we find that with such an astounding number, of course, it has a direct correlation to it. If we're inactive, the mind is not staying sharp.
So you're saying if you exercise, you're going to see a 50 to 60% reduction in Alzheimer's risk. Over what period, how much exercise are we talking about? How quickly would someone, say, getting involved in an exercise program, would we see that reduction in risk?
Well, and again, these are coming from studies. There was a study at the University of British Columbia, and they said you actually don't have to have that much exercise. Specifically, this one leaned on aerobic exercise. That's not to say that other types of exercise don't work and create different pathways. You have an uptake of oxygen with all exercise. They just studied the aerobic one. But 20 minutes a day, 3 to 4 times a week is enough. We don't have to, today we tend to focus on high intensity exercises, you know, 7-minute workouts, 12-minute workouts. It's the new fad. But they're saying that's actually not necessary. Moderate amounts of aerobic exercise are enough to keep the brain sharp. And even small amounts like 20 minutes work well for all ages. When we're talking about the ages, there was a study at the University of Illinois. They found that elementary school children exercising 40 minutes a day caused an IQ increase of 3.8 points. If we go to college students who worked out, they benefited as well. They increased their test scores by 17 points on average, working out daily. And then any people 50 years or older scored 20% higher in cognitive tests while they're undertaking these studies. So it goes across the age. So you can go from, you get benefits from young people right into older age.
And the way that you're describing it, it sounds like those effects manifest themselves pretty quickly.
They do. They really do. That's why these studies are coming out at such a rapid pace. Scientists are really getting excited. And look, the real thing about it is we don't have to go overboard. Mm-hmm. Exercise can be done in a moderate fashion, and we can get all the benefits from it. We don't have to go extreme on it. We don't have to follow a fad. And quite frankly, people who are going into older age, you know, if you're going 60, 70, 80, you're not going to be able to do that anyway. So even a brisk walk will be very beneficial to you.
Well, yeah, I it seems like the people who would be most interested in this information would be the people who are getting older, more concerned about Alzheimer's, and yet they're the ones that typically tend to be less active as we get older. But a lot of older people probably would be intimidated by the idea of starting exercise. What do you say to the older person who says, "Well, I'm too old for that"?
You know, there is no one too old to exercise. Exercise should never be intimidating. I think we think of exercise as doing something in the gym, being around big crowds, lifting heavy weights. But that's exactly what these studies are pointing out, that we don't have to do that. You can enjoy any type of exercise that you're used to, getting out and being about with people, tennis, perhaps taking a jog. If you can't jog anymore, your knees are bad, go for a brisk walk. Anything that you enjoy doing. And if you like to do it by yourself, that's fine. Having a partner with you to, you know, take that edge off, well, that would help as well.
Sometimes is it a matter of getting heart rate up, getting your breath going to a certain rate, sweating a certain amount? What are we kind of aiming for as a target?
We are looking at oxygen uptake. So when I say we should go for a walk, you should try to elevate your heart rate a little bit. So if you're walking, go for a brisk walk. Mm-hmm. And make sure that oxygen reaches the brain. Nobody's saying you have to be out of breath. The studies aren't saying that. They're saying, look, a moderate amount, but just a very, very slow walk. If that's all you can do, that's all you can do. But yeah, if you can walk a little bit faster, take a 20-minute walk and just go for a nice brisk walk, that will help. Now, for those people who are, doing strength training, they're saying, well, what about me? You know, I'm not a cardio person. It doesn't matter. If you can do circuits, say you're strength training or you're into something like CrossFit, your heart rate would be up with that anyways, but some other type of strength training, just take up some running in between. Do something that takes the benefits of both for the body and for the mind.
So I think earlier in the interview, you mentioned that that there might be some kinds of exercise that are actually better for brain health. You're mentioning this one study that specifically mentioned aerobic activity. Was there anything to suggest that one is better than the other?
Well, again, these studies are just now focusing on aerobic, but we know the common denominator is oxygen uptake. So if we look at a lot of the exercises today, myself, I do a lot of circuit training. So I do strength training, but with circuits. My heart rate is up. So we can take any of the modern forms of exercising. As I mentioned, CrossFit, you can do strength training and do sprints in between. But specifically, any kind of exercise where you have coordination, rhythm, and strategy in it. So if you take circuit training and you do speed work, jumps, and weights, well, that's wonderful for the brain, because then you're getting all the strategies that give you the benefits by redirecting your attention. It's making sure that the mind is active during the exercise. That's the key component.
So in other words, just getting on a treadmill and watching reruns from the Food Network while you're doing it, that's not necessarily going to provide as much benefit as something where your mind is really engaged in what you're doing?
Well, that's right. There's better ways of doing it. So they said, which I found astounding, even ballroom dancing. Ballroom dancing, which takes a lot of coordination. Well, your mind is just in high gear,
right?
Because there's so much required for you to move, to think, to balance, to make sure you know where your body is as you're moving.
Especially if you have an awkward ballroom dancing partner.
Well, again, that's what they said, but I'm not a ballroom dancer myself, so I'll stick to my circuit training.
Have you ever tried ballroom dancing with dumbbells in your hands? That's the question.
That I have not tried, no. That would make for another interesting story.
Well, can you exercise too much? Is there kind of a sweet spot?
You know, there is, and that's a good question, because you know the saying, if a little is good, a lot is better. That's how people think today. And that's not necessarily right. And we're actually being cautioned against that. That seems to be the fad today. A fellow called Justin Rhodes, he's a neuroscientist at the Oregon Health and Science University in Portland, found that there's a protein called BDNF, which we talked about. It can increase dramatically after excessive amounts of exercise. So we have athletes who run very, very long distances. However, he said, you can actually max that protein out and it can backfire on you. So here's where we're getting into moderation again. You know, if a little is good, a lot isn't necessarily better. So good health comes about when we do things in a consistent manner and in a moderate manner to glean long-term benefits, rather than saying, look, I'm going to do this for the next 6 weeks. I'm just going to rip it up. I'm going to do all I can. And then you just burn out. Mm-hmm. I mean, what's the use? Because we do have, you know, if you have 60, 70 years of life, that 12 weeks isn't going to matter much. Mm.
So you want to find something that you can stick with. And what you're telling us, as far as these studies are saying, it doesn't matter what age you are, you're going to enjoy greater brain health. Your cognitive function will increase. Exercise will really help you in your thinking. No matter what your age, and as you get older, it could actually stave off some of the more troubling effects of aging that tend to plague a lot more people these days than they ever have, and keep us healthy long into our old age. So we really appreciate you bringing this information to our attention. We've been talking with certified personal trainer Jörg Mardian about exercise's effect on brain health. He's working on an article about this for thetrumpet.com. You can watch for that in the time ahead. Thanks, Jörg, for your time.
Good to be here.
It's time for today's last word.
Confused by all the conflicting advice on food and nutrition out there? Don't be. At its heart, healthy eating is simple. Here's one rock-solid nutritional principle. As much as possible, eat foods that God created you to eat the way He created them. God created us to need food, and He created food to fulfill that need. He made our bodies to benefit the most from food that is in the form He created it. man can't make anything that God made any better. For example, God made apples. An apple is a wonderful food. Ingredients list, apple. If you want to make apples more of a treat, make applesauce. Just slice the apples, cook them for about 8 hours, season them if you want it to with cinnamon or nutmeg, puree, and enjoy. Food manufacturers, however, are more concerned with selling food than with our health, and they'll use anything they can to make their food look better, taste better, last longer, and even unnaturally make you crave more. Mott's Healthy Harvest Summer Strawberry Applesauce has these ingredients: apples, water, high fructose corn syrup, strawberry puree, sugar, natural flavor, ascorbic acid, red 40. That is a not so wonderful food. As much as possible, avoid processed refined foods, refined sugar, white flour, refined vegetable oils, canned foods, unless you do your own canning, condensed milk, pasteurized milk, skim and low-fat milk, hydrogenated fats, additives, and artificial sweeteners. Most of these are loaded with chemicals, preservatives, taste enhancers, and colorings that God did not create for us to consume. People have created them to sell food and make money. A simple rule of thumb to remember is if it's in a can or a box that came out of a factory, it probably comes with problems. Read nutrition labels. Many of them contain a long list of unpronounceable ingredients that come from chemistry laboratories, not grandma's kitchen, even though it may say grandma's kitchen on the front. Emulsifiers, polysorbate 20, potassium propionate, azotic carbonamide enzymes, propylene glycol, alginate, and so on. As you're reading labels, consider this. The United States Food and Drug Administration currently permits manufacturers to add 93 ingredients to bread products without even mentioning them on the nutrition label. If you do buy something that comes in a box or a can, choose items with fewer ingredients. If it has more than 6 ingredients, try to find something else. Ingredients that you can pronounce and recognize are better for you. Modern food production has created a lot of allergies. Food sensitivities and allergies can wreak havoc on your system. You might be suffering from food allergies without realizing it, so you're hurting yourself every time you unknowingly eat an allergen. This even extends to basic foods that God created but that have been processed by food factories, especially these items: milk, eggs, wheat, soy, peanuts, tree nuts such as almonds, cashews, and walnuts, and fish like bass, cod, and flounder. If you are often unwell, try getting off all these ingredients and see how you feel. Then add them back one at a time to see which one makes you worse. A basic rule that educator Herbert W. Armstrong promoted was, eat only those natural foods that will spoil and eat them before you do. If you keep this in mind, you'll eat far less refined food and processed food loaded with preservatives. You'll eat far more fresh fruits and vegetables, fresh meats, and whole grains. Educate your taste buds to enjoy food as God made it. Train yourself to enjoy whole foods for desserts, fruits and nuts, for example, and healthier desserts, cakes and cookies with whole flours and whole sweeteners. The more you eat them instead of processed junk food, the more you'll enjoy them. When we eat whole foods, our bodies assimilate nutrients better. For example, what happens when you eat whole grain, whole wheat? Well, the outside of the wheat kernel, the bran and the germ, that contains almost all of the vitamins, minerals, and enzymes, helps you digest the starchy part, the endosperm, within. What happens when you eat wheat that has been refined? Your body still needs those vitamins, minerals, enzymes to digest the starchy part, but they've been removed. Only the starchy part remains. This means that your body has to pull those vitamins, minerals, and enzymes from your own bones, tissues, and organs in order to digest it. When you eat a refined product, not only are you missing out on the wonderful nutrients God created in it, you're actually robbing your body of those nutrients. Whole foods give you nutrients. Man-made counterfeits take nutrients from you. Eat whole wheat rather than refined flour, whole grain pasta, brown rice rather than white rice, whole fruits and vegetables with the skins. Don't let the cacophony of conflicting nutritional advice confuse you. Start simple. Eat whole foods. I'm Joel Hilliker, and we're coming to the end of Trumpet Hour. If you like this program, we want to give you a subscription to The Trumpet Magazine. This is our monthly news magazine featuring the writers that you hear on this show. To receive The Trumpet every month for free, go online to thetrumpet.com. You can also go there for daily analysis on the events of the day and how they fulfill the prophecies of the Bible. Feel free to send us your thoughts on this program by emailing letters@thetrumpet.com. I want to thank my guests today, Robert Morley, Richard Palmer, Andrew Miller, and Jorg Mardian. And thanks to our technical staff, Dwight Falk, Josh Sloan, and Abraham Blondo. I'll leave you with this thought from Marcus Aurelius. Do not consider anything for your interest which makes you break your word, quit your modesty, or inclines you to any practice which will not bear the light or look the world in the face. Thank you for joining us on Trumpet Hour. It's been a pleasure. Until next time, keep watching your world.
You've been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.